Join us in person to hear Dr. Jim Gates discuss superstring theory, The Matrix, his latest book, Proving Einstein Right, and much more. That's 10 a.m. Wednesday, January 22nd at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn. Hope to see you there.
Thank you for that. Ladies and gentlemen, that last programming was Guns and Butter, hosted by Bonnie Faulkner. You can hear every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Ladies and gentlemen, get ready for the next show, Talk Out of School, with Miss Carol Buras, coming up.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass.
Good morning. My name is Carol Buras, and I'm the executive director of the Network for Public Education based right here in New York City. And this is Talk Out of School, a show in which we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, the state, and nationally. Now, one of the issues on which all of the major Democratic candidates agree is the importance of early childhood education. Many of the campaign platforms include federal funding for what candidates refer to as high-quality, universal pre-kindergarten for all 3- and 4-year-olds. The question, of course, is how do we define high-quality pre-K? Is it full day or is it half day? Is high-quality pre-K skills-based, or is it play-based, or both? I remember that the three experiences that our three daughters had in preschool were very different, and I'm now finding differences in the experiences of our grandchildren. So the question becomes, how can parents make informed decisions when searching for the best program for their child? Today we have two outstanding experts in early childhood education who will answer these questions and more. First guest is Denisha Jones. Denisha is the director of the Art of Teaching program at Sarah Lawrence College. She is also the director for early childhood organizing for Defending the Early Years, which is a nonprofit organization working for a just, equitable, and quality early childhood education for every child. Dr. Jones was a kindergarten teacher and a preschool director before she became a teacher educator. Our second guest is Susan Ochthorn. Susan is a writer, policy analyst, and advocate for whole child education, especially during the early years. A former journalist with a degree in early childhood education and public policy, Susan has written for national publications and is the author of Squandering America's Future, Why Early Childhood Education Policy Matters for Equality, Our Economy, and Our Children. She is presently working on a new book about play as the foundation for democracy and civil society. Good morning, Susan and Denisha. How are you today?
Good. Good morning, Carol. Very good.
Good morning, Carol.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on. Now, I want to let everybody know that Denisha and Susan are members of the Board of Directors of the Network for Public Education, and both Denisha and Susan will be presenting at our Network for Public Education conference in March. Please be sure to sign up to attend. It's in Philadelphia this year. All you need to do is go to www.npeaction.org and sign up. And we want you to enter the dialogue this morning, too. So be sure to call in at the break at 212-209-2877. So let's start, if you would, talking about the program that we have now in New York City. I know we've made some great strides in providing access to preschool education for all children. Can you describe it a little bit for us?
Yeah. It's our preschool, which is called preschool program, pre-K for all, was very, very much welcome. You know, New York State had actually Governor Pataki, a Republican, introduced universal pre-kindergarten for New York State in 1975. And here came in, de Blasio came in, and he really saw it as what he called an inequality buster. He was going to pay for it by, interestingly, taxing the wealthy. The cost of a soy latte a day was what was said. And, you know, the U.S., Carol, is very, in terms of preschool provision, is in the lower half of the Economic Intelligence Unit and Index for provision of preschool across 45 nations and in the world. And, you know, only 6 in 10 kids are not enrolled. I mean, 6 in 10 kids are not enrolled, not only, excuse me. So I personally really was ecstatic. We had been longing for it for a long time. And it was just really much needed. And the issue, though, the implementation was very rapid. And there were many critics, you know, skeptics who thought, oh, you know, he's not going to be able to do it. And how are we going to get up to quality? And while I shared those concerns, I knew that we had to grab this opportunity, that actually de Blasio was seizing the moment. And I think it was really one of his most progressive ideas. And, you know, he's been very disappointing, to say the least, on many other areas. So the problem was, though, so they got, I think it was something like 45,000 kids in full-day universal pre-kindergarten in the first year. And everybody was liking it. The parents were very receptive. And then as they began, they were going to provide preschool for all four-year-olds the following year. And we're talking about 2014 and 2015. Very, very rapid. And there was something at that point. I remember de Blasio was on one of the morning shows, and he said something that really disturbed me. It set up a red flag. And he said the city was planning to use the Common Core curriculum in pre-kindergarten. And he also said that children who were in classrooms that were informed by the rigor of the Common Core would be imbued with a love of learning. Now, this was problematic. And, you know, all of the issues with K through 12 education, and by the way, K through third grade is early childhood education. We often don't include it. But according to the National Association for the Education of Young Children, we're talking about birth to 8. But in New York City, we really have not looked at the in kindergarten through third grade, that is the early primary years, as part of the education and care that we give to young children. And this is a major problem because with the implementation of the Common Core, there was a shadow upon the earliest years. Basically, the standards were back mapped.
Right.
And while there was a pretty developmentally appropriate foundation for the Common Core for preschool, de Blasio was facing, and Farina at the time, were facing the pressure of implementing the Common Core, and it was therefore getting pushed down to younger and younger children.
Now, before, if I could just stop you for a moment, before we go deeper into some of the issues of curriculum and the concerns that you both share. If we could just back up a little bit about the description of the program, because I'll tell you, as a New York City grandma, I'm not even sure. Is this program a mixture of private and public, and does every child in the city?
Is.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that, Susan?
Yes, I can. It is like the field, the whole field itself of early childhood education. It is a patchwork. Yes, it is a mixture of private and public. It is some of the the majority, actually, of the UPK slots are in community-based organizations, which has its own problem in terms of pay parity, which I hope we're going to talk about. And then they are also in public schools and also in freestanding what are now being called pre-K centers. And so the idea is that, you know, children should be able to go to, you know, to have parents have a choice if depending upon where they live. And that's true of the entire school system. You know, New York City is so influenced by residential segregation, and so that's where they are. The problem is that with community-based organizations, nonprofits are getting money. They're getting universal pre-kindergarten money, and some of them, you know, many of them have been providing. I'm going into curriculum, but they've been providing a very high quality, rich early childhood education, but they too are now beholden to the Common Core because their funding is coming from that stream.
Wow, I didn't know that. So as long as they take money, so let's say, for example, a child is four years old, parents are both working, they have them in a daycare center for the whole day, which also has the pre-K.
Child care,
thank you. Child care center for the whole day. And then what happens is they, are you saying that they also can get money from the city to run? And then if they get the money from the city, then that means that they have to implement the city curriculum.
That's right. I will give you a great example from my own grandchildren's early childhood center, which is a wonderful, wonderful program that is in Hudson, New York, upstate north of Manhattan, a couple of hours. And they have, in fact, I've written about Harriet Krinehart. She has an amazing program. It's very much modeled sort of on a childcare, on a family childcare kind of setting. And it's in a retrofitted house, and it's wonderful, and it's very rich, and the children do a lot of playing, and they go to the nature preserves, and they're playing in mud and all of the kinds of things that little ones, you know, really should be doing. And yet she told me, you know, she feels incredible pressure. She needs to keep that funding. And so, you know, my youngest grandchild, who is four, is, you know, it's having, you know, is having the kinds of pre-literacy kind of curriculum that is not always best for children.
Okay. Denisha, I'm wondering if you might enter the conversation a little bit and talk about some of the concerns that you have, piggybacking on what Susan said, about what is happening in our early childhood education programs with a specific focus on pre-K, since that's the theme of this show.
Sure. I'm new to New York, so I don't know all of the details specifically, but I know nationally when we've seen universal pre-K come in, we've seen a couple of issues. Like Susan mentioned, there's an increase in standards and rigor, which is not really developmentally appropriate for young children. So now, because of the funding coming in, the state now wants to see all sorts of achievement gains in pre-K. And so they're making teachers, you know, teach certain way and certain things because they want to see kind of there's more accountability once the state starts paying for the child care, right? And I'm not opposed to accountability, but, you know, preschool accountability shouldn't look like, you know, public school accountability. And what do we really believe are the markers of good early childhood quality care should be the focus. And so that's been an issue. And I know the focus is on pre-K, but one of the issues that I think really that people really need to examine is the impact on infant and toddler care and access when you shift to universal pre-K. A lot of programs that are not able to get the universal pre-K funding, or they can't sustain their infant toddler programs without parents enrolling in universal in pre-K. So if the parents leave to go to a universal pre-K program, they're not really able to offer affordable infant and toddler care because they don't have those parents who are paying for the pre-K, which was helping to keep the cost down for infant toddler care. Infant toddler care is very expensive because of the ratios that you have to have, you know, less children and more adults and other reasons why it costs a lot more. So that's just an issue to think about as we move forward thinking about access, because access to pre-K is important, but then what does that mean for infant and toddler? For parents who need both, a lot of parents have young children who are in pre-K and also need infant toddler care, and we're seeing that that can be a reaction that's not really good. And then also, I know for myself, I was in D.C. before I came to New York. The pre-K program, our pre-K program is in the public schools. So every public school in Washington, D.C. offers pre-K 3 and 4. But what happened was organizations like Head Start, which were federal programs that were specific for early learning care, they no longer offer a pre-K. They don't do the pre-K. The pre-K is taken over by the public school. So you see less developmentally appropriate practices in those programs. Not all. Some are great. I used to go observe my students in many of them. But, you know, we lost out on being able to Head Start offering those. And Head Start had a different approach to what quality looked like, engaging parents, engaging families, supporting family literacy programs and those sorts of things. So, and you don't always find them in public school programs if they're not aware of the importance of those programs. So those are definitely some of the issues. But again, to Susan's point, it's the push down of the academics, which really isn't developmentally appropriate as more and more states take on universal pre-K. And we hear this in, you know, the Democratic nominee candidates are, you know, touting these programs. And we used to get really excited when we heard about universal pre-K because we know that access is really important for families in all over the country. But then we started to realize, oh, it's coming with a lot of, you know, things attached that are not very not very good. So now we're worried about, well, how much do we want universal pre-K if it means turning pre-K 3 and 4 into the new kindergarten and kindergarten into the new second grade, right? Right. That's not what we want. And so we need to be really cautious with that.
Yeah, so it sounds as though neither of you are opposed to the idea, but the problem is that both the states and the federal government have the wrong-headed approach when it comes to the education of our very youngest children. And so I guess my question then is, as we move from the local in New York and even the national stage to the international stage, who are the countries that we should be looking at? Where are the places, if any, in the world that actually do a very good job when it comes to educating its youngest citizens?
Well, we have, and this is delighting me to no end, China, I'm going to answer in one word, and Denisha, we can tag team on this, I think.
Yes.
there is a revolution going on in this authoritarian country. And it is by the name of Angie Play. And it was there is a visionary, Ms. Cheng, who is a visionary, I would say, along the lines of Maria Montessori. And she has created a curriculum for preschool that has five elements. Joy, Denisha, I might need help on this. Joy, what? Love, reflection, risk, and what's and the fifth?
Engagement.
Engagement.
Yeah.
Wow. That's,
yeah.
And
it's
not
really,
only that.
Really.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. I was.
Denisha.
Yeah, it's a really interesting. Both Susan and I had the pleasure of visiting Anji. So Anji's rural province in China. It's about 3 hours drive from Shanghai. So that's what's really the first part. It's in rural China. It's not in the big cities. And their kindergarten, what we consider early childhood for them, is called kindergarten, and it's ages 3 to 6, and it's government funded. And Ms. Cheng was, you know, 16, 17 years ago, she was given control of the program and developed the preschools and, you know, watching the children and just kind of seeing, looking at their eyes and kind of seeing that they weren't really happy, right? And so what was happening, and then as they it kind of shifted. They were doing some what she called false play, which where they were presenting like some toys and giving them a little bit play. But when they got rid of all the, you know, traditional play structures and toys and just really let children engage with open-ended materials, they saw this kind of the joy that really sparks when children can play. And she was able to, you know, after studying it with the teachers and the parents, implement it in all of the Anji preschools. And now China wants to take it across the country. And so there was the first True Play Conference last May in Anji. Both Susan and I were able to attend. There were about 100 international guests, but then about 200, you know, guests across mainland China who want to see it too. So it's not, you know, it's a revolution that they're trying to spread, but there were teachers from Hong Kong who were like, we can't do this. Like, we don't do this at all. So it's definitely like, you know, it's a shock to people in China to see this happening in this little province. But it's growing. I mean, people just see the benefits. The parents see that their children are happy and joyful and love going to school. The teachers are seeing the children in a whole new light. They see them as more competent and confident. And the administrators, there were so many high-level Chinese education officials there who also have been to these schools and see how good it is. And then another best part is as the children transition into first grade, and, you know, those teachers are then realizing that they're not giving mm-hmm. children their full potential, and they're coming and looking at the children in Anji, and they see what they can do, and they're like, we're not letting them continue this on. So it's causing this whole movement where people are really, really looking at playing. So that's why Susan and I immediately went to Anji, because it is a good example. Of course, there are other great childcare programs in a lot of the Scandinavian countries, in Norway and Finland. They're in Sweden. They're doing amazing things. They've always done outdoor play, full play-based programs, and those programs are really great. But I don't think as many people know about Anji China and what they're doing out there as well.
Well, it'd be really interesting to see the implications for Chinese society as these young children grow.
I think that is my major question about this, especially the way it's going now and with surveillance and you know, ongoing repression and Big Brother, you know. But I think that the issue, as it has been in the United States, is to push this up into a very punitive, I'm sure you know, kind of education system where it is cutthroat, where parents go to villages to prepare to support their children as they are involved in test prep for the high school exam and university. It is absolutely, you know, brutal. So the question is pushing up, and that's really the challenge here in the United States. Also, I wanted to talk about a wonderful experience I had in Oslo, where I met a woman named Ivor Ensrud, and she started the hashtag was a kindergarten riot. There was an assessment that was coming down from top, because all of even the Nordic countries, which are known for the good childhood in quotes, are facing the push to really get kids, really a commodification of kids, really pushing them to be, you know, hamsters on a treadmill. And that is really happening throughout the world. But anyway, Ivor was a kindergarten teacher, and as in China, kindergarten refers to the ages of 2 through 6 or 3 through 6 before the children go to primary school. And they were trying to push down, pass this assessment for in Oslo, across the country, to test children, I think at 4 or 5, to see, it was a literacy assessment, and she was so angry about it. She blogged about it, and suddenly she had thousands, I think it was something like 8,000, kindergarten teachers all over the country, and they were able to push back. Which
wonderful.
Was so, so exciting. So Ivor then, of course, became this. She actually went on to take a position as deputy of culture and education in Oslo. She was invited by one of their progressive political parties. But before that, she was she visited New York City, so back to the local. She was a guest of Josh Wallach, and she was taken to, a couple of preschool classrooms, and she was not happy at all. She mentioned to me that she saw one of the teachers working on what the teacher called a play plan with the child, which was so constraining and so rationalistic. And, you know, Ivor said, this is, she was horrified. This is not how, you know, we do it. There was no sense of the freedom and the child-directed kind of play and just joy of discovery. It was all, you know, a schedule, which is how pre-Ks are now, both in New York City and across the country in the United States.
Now, you both often express worries about the present direction of early childhood education from an international movement that you refer to as GERM. Right? Not only you, but many people. So I'm wondering, Denisha, could you talk a little bit about GERM, what it is, and what that GERM stands for?
Sure. So I want to say, I don't know who coined the term. When I talk about GERM, I reference Pafisalbo, but I don't know if he was. Yeah, okay. I thought he coined it, but I wasn't quite sure. But it stands for the Global Education Reform Movement. So as I mentioned, right, we talked about those Scandinavian countries and how great they are, but their early childhood programs are under attack because of GERM, because they're the global education reform movement that we see in many countries that is kind of, you know, it's like the powers that be, the oligarchs are kind of, they want to kind of change education internationally and make it more of a streamlined practice, right? And so there are some tenets to GERM that include, you know, standardization, right? That all education should be standards-based and that you should have national standards. And we have that here. We have the Common Core, and now we have states aligning their pre-K standards to Common Core. There's also this idea that you can, you can streamline the cost of early care, all types of education, right, by kind of narrowing it down to just the technical aspects of, you know, seeing education as a business and inputs and outputs and that sorts of things as well, too. So what happens is when these reform efforts come in, and they come in through different types of conservative party leaders in different country governments and local state governments, they kind of start impacting the ability of early childhood teachers to really produce, you know, education that we know is really important for young children. And there becomes a lot of pushdown. You see accountability movements growing. You see testing. There is a big international early learning standards test that Susan and I was on a panel speaking about it about a year or two ago. And it's like a big, you know, I think three countries, it went down, there were a bunch of countries involved, and then it was just United States, England, and I think it was Poland was the third. But they're doing early childhood assessments of four-year-olds on iPads. And it's that kind of thinking that, one, we need the data, and we don't. We have plenty of data how children are doing in programs and developing, and a lot of that comes from looking at zip codes and looking at parental income, and you can kind of get a good sense of how students are doing. But to collect this data nationally, and then it drives all sorts of policies and programs that are just not appropriate, and it's not what children need. And so that becomes an issue as well, too. And so the GERM movement, we see it, you know, impacting globally, right? Even when we were in China and Ms. Cheng was talking about some of the issues there that led to the play revolution, I saw that similar to some of the things she said was related to GERM overall, right? That there were people who just didn't believe in investing in early childhood care, that they didn't think that young children needed a separate type of environment that really helped them develop and grow. They wanted everything to seem more aligned with what was happening in our education for all students, a very technical, autocratic type of education. And so it's become a huge issue, but there are still places that are trying to get around it.
Right, and we have the two of you warriors fighting back on all of this, so that makes me hopeful. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, Denisha and Susan are going to speak with us more about this very, very important topic of early childhood education. And we want you to enter the dialogue at around 10:45. You can start to call in now with your questions at the break. That number is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We'll be back in just a few moments.
I'm Joyello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
We are gonna sing the same song.
Ladies and gentlemen, join the award-winning Midnight Ravers on Friday, January 24th, 2020, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. as we proudly present Israel Vibration, Rude Boys Shuffling. We'll present the music and history of this dynamic Jamaican band, so be sure to tune in. Again, that's Friday, January 24th, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Miss it and hate yourself.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Back with Talk Out of School. Joining me today is Susan Oxhorn and Denisha Jones. Both are experts on early childhood education, and they're talking with me about what a present early childhood education looks like in New York City in the United States, but even more importantly, what early childhood education should be. Thanks, Denisha and Susan. Glad to have you back.
Glad to be here.
So, I guess, as I think about some of these issues, we talk about what's developmentally appropriate and what's not. And it's probably going to vary from child to child. And there are some kids who are precocious in terms of academic curiosity. They may want to, you know, engage in letter recognition or do some numeracy exercises. How do you meld that in a program that's play-based? Is it possible to do that?
Absolutely. You know, I don't want people to think that this is not happening in the United States. We talked internationally, but I know of some amazing early childhood educators in the United States who run play-based programs that are just amazing, right? So one in particular I talk about is called Discovery Learning, and it's in Poolsville, Maryland, and it's run by Lakeisha Reed. And in her program, and she shares pictures, she runs a play group. So there's a group of educators, early childhood educators who do play programs, and they share pictures of the children playing in videos. And what I see as a member of the group, for what they share, is that children do it all the time. Children read, they write, they count, they do math, they do science, but they do it at their own pace because it's something they need to engage with their play, right? So they'll be doing some play and all of a sudden want to make a sign. And so they'll get up and get the paper and the pens and they'll write a sign, or they'll want to make a play and they'll write a script, or they want to read a book and they'll read a book. But it's not a teacher sitting them down at 11:10 and saying, everybody come to circle and right. Listen to me read you this book, right? It's a exactly. Very different. And so when children have that freedom, they do it and they want to do it, right? And she calls it a place for childhood because that's what her space is. It's a place for children to be children and to enjoy this precious time in life called childhood without the constraints of an adult saying, I think you should be doing this because of this, right? They can do whatever, because play is learning. It's not a type of learning or the best way for learning. It is learning for young children. So, I mean, I'm amazed at all the pictures, and she's got other people in different programs across the country, and they share their photos and their videos. And what you realize is that children, yes, they need to learn how to read and write, but they need to get the desire to want to do those skills, right? They need to have a drive for it, because you can make a child a reader at the age of 5. But if you don't make them someone who wants to read,
right,
that's what we're seeing is happening, right? When we force children to do it on our terms, they don't have the innate desire for that. And that's the problem.
Right. I mean, that's such a critical point to make. And, you know, I see now that, especially with my grandkids, that there are all kinds of educational materials on the market right now. I'm thinking of one particular product line called Leapfrog. And they have all kinds of interactive toys with pre-reading activities, math activities. So what do you think about those programs? And if a child actually shows interest in that, is that necessarily a bad thing?
It's not that it isn't a bad thing. And I think that parents have to make those choices. But what we're saying is that we also have to remove kids from this pressure. You know, we're seeing high rates of anxiety, depression, even suicide in older children who have been on this treadmill. And we can't, you know, we have a country in which children hate kindergarten. They do not want to go to school. They are being asked now, because of the Common Core standards, to be reading to do close reading with fluency by the end of kindergarten. And they are, especially those who have come out of preschools that are developmentally appropriate, like the ones that Janisha has just described, and they do exist. Their love of learning is being squashed. And this is a tragedy. To put a 4 or a 5-year-old on a computer to take a readiness assessment is a form of child abuse.
Yeah.
So, Carol, it's not, you know, it's every parent and teacher, you know, every parent makes a decision about the kinds of toys and, you know, and stimulation that they want to give their child. But there also has to be, you know, a kind of a faith and confidence that children will develop, and that each, as you said, each child develops at his or her own pace. This is the problem. This is why standards, one of Peter Rawich, a former first grade teacher in upstate New York, said it's an oxymoron. Development is unique, and we need to really attend and be attuned to the whole child. And with so many, I mean, in New York City, a percentage of very high percentage of children, particularly in the public schools, who are Black and brown, and many children living in poverty. We have very high poverty rate. They are being exposed to all kinds of toxic stresses, what we call adverse childhood experiences. They're coming to school, and the pressure is enormous on them. And there is no empirical evidence, I'd love to do a study. I've been thinking about that, of the connection and the correlation to preschool expulsion and suspension, which is really skyrocketing, especially for little Black boys across the nation. You know, these kids are not meant to be sitting in chairs at desks.
Right.
And especially for children who have special needs, with all kinds of different multiple intelligences, as Howard Gardner called them, this is a travesty.
Right.
And I am the grandmother of one of those children who is in a special school. But, you know, his school in upstate New York does talk about, the foundation of the Common Core. It is really problematic. And I think that, United States is the only developed nation not to sign the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And one of the rights of the child is to play. It is the primary engine of human, mammalian development.
Right. I'm wondering something that you mentioned before that is really critically important, and this is an observation that I've seen, again looking at the school where my grandson goes, and that's teacher turnover rate.
He is
wonderful. He has wonderful teachers. They are super, super people. Most of his teachers are women of color. And what I see is churn. And he's heartbroken, and his mom is heartbroken because the teacher leaves, and the reason she leaves is pay. We hear it all the time, substandard wages that have no connection to the wages that our teachers have in public schools. Can you talk about that? Because, boy, that really upsets me a lot.
Well, I could speak to that's happening all over the country, but I can speak to New York City, where the issue of pay parity has really shone brightly. That was really one of the Achilles heels of de Blasio's initiative. And as much as we welcomed it, it was so long sought. They did not integrate pay parity, equal salaries between community-based early childhood teachers, most of women of color, yes, and public school teachers. And there has been a mammoth struggle here in the city to get that. We are making progress, but it is still not a done deal. And you're absolutely right, Carol, as for the stability and consistency that children are losing with turnover, those are the hallmarks of high quality education. Children, as everyone does, learn in relation to a stable, loving, engaging, and consistent kind of adult in the room. This is the cornerstone of of really healthy development in children. And our children are not getting that. Moreover, the educators in community-based organizations they themselves are living in poverty. They themselves are exposed to toxic stress. So you have like this double whammy of children who are vulnerable being in early childhood settings with adults who are also vulnerable. Well, and that is a disaster.
Yeah,
that is what protects against toxic stress.
Right.
Is to have an adult who is, who is not suffering from toxic stress.
Right. And, and one of the things that I want to emphasize, too, is that, the women that I've encountered, because I go to his school often, pick him up, they're wonderful, wonderful women, devoted women who are doing, I think, heroic work. Denisha, I'm wondering if you have anything to add on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, as a teacher educator, it's really been difficult in 15 years. I've been preparing mainly women, some men, to work in teaching and primarily early education. And, it was always a kind of a joke, like, well, marry well, ladies, because you're not going to make a lot of money and I want you to stay in the field. And that's sad, but it's true. I myself was a kindergarten teacher and I was waitressing at the same time, and I made more money, quite frankly, on the weekends at the restaurant than I did in my paycheck as a kindergarten teacher in Washington, D.C. Right. That was just the reality. And there were teaching jobs I had to turn down because they didn't pay enough and the schedule was too late and I needed to get to my restaurant job. Right. So it just becomes such a challenge when the work is so important and we want people to do it well. But because we said this is a woman dominated profession, we somehow think that they don't deserve to make decent money, right? Taking care of other people's children, which is so important. And that's why we say childcare and not daycare, because it's really important. People think it's okay to pay a childcare worker minimum wage, right? The fight for 15 in a lot of cities includes mainly child care workers in those cities who are not even making $15 an hour. And we can't expect the cost just to fall on parents paying tuition, right?
Right.
Because we know how expensive child care is. You know,
yep.
I had friends who were paying $1,000 a month per child. That is, to me, like, I don't even understand how you could afford something like that, let alone, you know, and that was regular child care. That wasn't, like, top-of-the-line expensive private care. That
mm-hmm.
wasn't subsidized. That was just your everyday at the Y child care, $1,000 a month per child in pre-K. And so we can't expect that to raise the salary of those teachers should fall on those parents who are already paying that much to have to pay more, right? It has to be an investment from this country, from this government that says, we believe that young children need to be in high quality care, and we believe that the people who provide that care should be paid a living wage, should be, you know, be able to go to work and not have to worry about providing for their own families, right? So as I work with these young kids today, young women and men who want to become teachers, it's still really frustrating. Sometimes I feel like it's a setup to take all your money at this college, have you go into debt in this degree,
right?
And then you're barely going to be making enough money to pay that off, right? Because the field has such disparities, and not all of them. Some of them will go into private centers because they'll make more money, or, you know, but it's tough. It really is tough. And it's just a lot of challenges, and we just don't see the investment needed from society to change that.
I think it's true. And, you know, when you think about it, when you think about the people who work with our two most vulnerable populations, the very young and the very old. What do we
exactly.
see? We
yes.
we see substandard wages,
mm-hmm.
and it's a travesty. You know, I'm really, really happy because we have lots of questions because you
yes.
are such fabulous guests, and we're going to start taking them now. Hey, hi, this is Carol Burris. This is WBAI. Who are we speaking with?
Good morning. My name is Marla Kilfoyle. I'm a retired educator out here on Long Island.
Morning, Marla.
I have a question for either Dr. Jones or Ms. Hawshorn. I'm calling to ask that, you know, I've noticed online that there's been a lot of talk about privatizing preschools, and in particular online preschools. And one of the most disturbing things I've read is something called social impact bonds, where you get wealthy hedge funders who invest in, quote unquote, trying to help children with special needs in preschool. And then what they end up doing is declassifying them before they head to kindergarten. I'm just wondering if either of them can talk about, you know, either the online preschool thing or the social impact bonds and how that could impact young children.
You read my
sure.
mind, Marla.
Yes.
Yes.
I know. That.
Yes.
Yeah. I was going to say,
well, we got to make a decision here. How about Susan on this one and Tanisha on the
okay.
next question?
Yes. I was going to say, Carol, at the end of your comment about Denisha's comment about, you know, there isn't investment in society, but what has happened is the same dark money that the free market is creating in K through 12 has really flooded early childhood education. You have some of the same philanthrocapitalists who are supporting, for instance, the Waltons are basically co-opting public Montessori, and they're doing it through charter schools, and majority of them in California. And you've got Jeff Bezos, who's putting his money into also Montessori preschool. We don't know how that's going to pan out. Then you have private equity and hedge funders who are using social impact bonds, which are also known as pay for success. And the problem is that this is really basically to make, to get profit for these very wealthy sort of social venture capitalists is what they call them, you know, what we would call them. And it is really, it's in their interest, they're to have very strong accountability. And they're not really interested in the well-being of children. They're interested in, you know, in outcomes, not inputs.
Okay. Well, our lines are really lighting up. So if we could move to the next question. Hi, this is Carol Burris. You're on the air. And who are you and what's your question?
Yes, good morning. My name is Charles and I'm calling from Harlem. And I just finished my professional studies degree in early childhood at NYU, and I decided not to do the teacher certification track. And so I'm wondering if you might, you know, tell me a little bit about what other ways that somebody, you know, with my experience might be involved with early childhood. And also if you could say a little bit about men in early childhood education.
Hey, Denisha.
Wow, yes, thank you so much. I haven't had a lie. I can count them on one hand, but I think about five or six men in my 15 years at teaching at the university have completed early childhood degrees, and I remember each of them very well. I think it's important to, you know, for a lot of different reasons, people don't take the teacher certification. EdTPA is challenging the state of New York, as we know, and other issues as well, too. But I think that there are a lot of avenues for people who want to work in young children, with young children, but definitely don't want to be teachers in the classroom. There's a lot of advocacy work that I'm learning about in New York City. So for one, I would reach out to a lot of the advocacy organizations in the city that do work around early childhood. Susan and I attended an event earlier last year, towards the end of last year, about the path forward, the pre-K, with the Educational Alliance and some other folks. I know that they're just, you know, there are so many organizations that are either doing teacher training or providing services before and after school or just doing advocacy work in communities as well. And I don't know the names of them off the top of my head, but I know New York is rich with these organizations. And so, you know, thinking about working for one of those programs might be a really good way to stay involved. There's also a lot of racial justice organizations that are looking at the early years and how it's really important to center their work around making it appropriate for young children and their families as well, too. And I just want to say we need a lot more men in early childhood education. It's always a joy when we have them. When we have students at our child care center at the college I'm at now, and when men come in to volunteer, you just see the kids' eyes light up. They're just not used to having men in the room in the program. And especially for some of the boys, they gravitate towards them and they develop these strong relationships with them. And the men that we do have in the program, they really see the value of working in education with young children. And so it's really important. But for a lot of reasons, it's a challenge for multiple reasons. It's not seen in the male profession. There are challenges within the profession for men. It's unfortunately, we still have a lot of work to do with our administrators and our colleagues to make sure that they're creating a supportive environment for men in the field. But I really encourage men, you know, if you think you like working with children, do some volunteer work. Thinking about getting in the classrooms and schools and after school programs and being mentors, because the children really need you in their lives. There's so many benefits there. So thank you so much.
When you think about early childhood education as it's happening in a lot of the community-based centers, and there may be other listeners who like our previous caller are interested in a career, what kind of certification is needed to be a teacher, and what kind of certification is needed to be a support person, a teaching assistant in the early childhood classroom?
So yeah, I know New York State, we offer an initial license to be in early childhood. So there is a requirement at the initial level to teach in pre-K through second grade or third grade is the early childhood area. And so New York State offers a license, different avenues, but a lot of it is going through a traditional teacher prep program. Some of those programs are offered at the undergraduate level. Some of them are exclusively at the graduate level. And you can get that initial certification with an undergraduate degree, but most teachers to stay in the field licensed in New York State will eventually need a master's degree for their professional certificate. As for other, I think I'm not sure about the assistant teacher because we don't have a program for that now, but I know some colleges offer licensures for assistant teachers as well, and it's probably slightly less requirements, but most states are moving to a bachelor's degree as a minimum for lead teachers, and even some states are doing that for assistant teachers, so it kind of varies across the field. And then for folks who want to do advocacy work, it's usually some type of training in either child development, which could be at the undergraduate master's degree. We see people getting social work degrees who are working with children. We're getting a lot of outreach from folks who don't, who work in other fields, but realize they need a child development background, right? Like lawyers, right? Especially right. immigration lawyers who are now working with young children who don't have the background. I'm fortunately an immigration lawyer, but I have the background in early childhood education.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're seeing that happen more and more. Other people who are reaching out and say, yeah, my clientele
right.
is growing.
Well, you know,
with
we
young
have,
children and,
yeah, I don't mean to interrupt, but we yeah. have, we're running out of time. We still have callers who have a question. So if we could move on to the next
sure.
call. Thank you. Hi, this is Carol Burris. You're on the air. Who is this, please, and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Michelle. I live in central New Jersey, and I've been an education activist in my local community for a while. I'm a board member for over 5 years now, and I feel very frustrated, so I'm calling for some advice. I see that there's a lot of austerity measures and authoritarianism worldwide. So the big picture thinker in me sees that happening locally, where education activists like myself seem to understand when we talk about the importance of play-based learning, the importance of activism.
Right. Could you kind of move on to the question, because we really are getting really
yeah,
close
so
to the end.
My question is, how do people understand certain things on a global level but fail to get them on the local level? So my frustration is that people don't seem to understand, like, the way that we treat our children. This is a quote. The way that we treat our children in the dawn of their lives and the way that we treat our elderly in the twilight of their lives is a measure of the quality of a nation.
Yeah.
They don't seem to understand that when we try to
right,
translate that
right.
into political activism.
You know, thank you. I think you're sharing your thoughts. We'd like to get to one more question, so thank you very much for calling. Next, please. Hi, next caller, Carol Burris. That's it. Okay, people. Sorry about that. It looks like the few people waiting are have moved on, and it really is time for us to end the show. So, you know, I would like to thank you so much, Susan and Denisha. We'd love to have you back at some point because I think this is such an important topic, and people were very, very engaged throughout the program. And I'd like to remind our listeners that if you like the show, don't forget to sign up online as a BAI buddy for Talk Out of School. That's what keeps us going. That's what keeps us on the air. And thanks for listening in. Next week, Lainey will be back as she hosts right here on WBAI FM at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, where we always talk out of school.
You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Gee, but the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street.
Court order. To consider amendments to its bylaws. Now, these bylaws protect the democratic governance system, key to our mission of promoting peace and justice through our broadcasts. The court order was initiated by Pacifica National Board members Donald Goldmacher from KPFA, Mansour Sabag from KPFK, and Bill Crozier from KPFT. Crozier was one of the board members who came and closed down WBAI on October 7th. However, in the opinion of a large majority of the Pacifica National Board, the proposed bylaws amendments are destructive, a slap in the face at all the activists who struggled for years to create a democratic governance structure for Pacifica. It would do away with our local station boards and replace them with rubber stamp advisory boards that now dominate NPR stations. It would put Pacifica under the absolute control of 6 transitional directors appointed by those who filed the lawsuit. They would even have final say over all Pacifica broadcasts, including over WBAI. I'm Alex Steinberg, pro tem chair of the Pacifica National Board and member of WBAI's local station board. I urge all delegates and members to study these bylaws carefully and vote your conscience. This is WBAI New York.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there. WBAI was there, and a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Yeah. Alive. WBAI. No
justice. This is listener-sponsored, locally-controlled WBAI New York.
Amended and restated Pacifica bylaws amendments have been proposed and may now be found on the Foundation's website at www.pacifica.org for review and have been voted on by the Pacifica National Board and are to be voted on by the station delegates, followed by a membership vote.
Thank you for that, Max. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. That last program was Talk Out of School, hosted by